Can you see the mirror or you won't like it?
That's
better.
Are you more in the back?
He's running around.
Okay, and everybody's here, I guess.
You have to give him a word with another
one. Yeah, so today we're happy to start our seminar series for the fall. And this is already an exception because typically at this time we should have the cosmology seminar. Today we have two string theory seminars. So typically the string theory seminar is at 2 o'clock on Tuesdays. In any case, we're happy to have Sebastian Franco here from Princeton, and he's going to tell us about correction of frames and dynamical supercharging.
Thank you very much. Well, before starting, let me thank everybody for the invitation to come here and for giving me the opportunity to present my work. The topics I will talk about today are based on this paper that I wrote with Amin Harani from MIT and Fouad Saad and Angel Braga from Universidad Autónoma de Madrid. And there's also a related paper that we before and wrote with Amin and Angel that's also close to the subject. So let me give you a brief outline of my presentation so you have more or less an idea of how I will organize the talk. First of all, I will say a few words about the AES-CFT correspondence and how to extend it to non-conformal theories and theories with less supersymmetry. And then it goes forward. I will talk about how to introduce fractional grains. I will use some renormalization root flows. I will discuss the shared example that everybody knows about the conic fold, how the duality cascade appears and what happens in the infrared of that theory. And then I will move on to talk about how complex deformations can be translated to the language of toric geometry, which are the type of geometries I will be discussing here today. This will lead to some classification of fractional grains, and then I will consider different examples in which we'll see that the interesting phenomena will appear in the infrared. So, one of the main ideas of recent years, now it's long ago, but the string theory is the AES-CFT correspondence, and one of the ways in which you can motivate it is by looking at some set of D3 grains and D3 grains from different perspectives. And on one side, you can look at the low energy limit, you can look at the open string center on the D3 grains, and what you have is a gauge theory leaning on the world volume of the D3 grains is an N-quad form. Super young means with SUN gauge group. You have three adjoint fields living there, which corresponds to the transfer directions to the D3 grains. And on the other side, you can also look at the same system by looking at how the D3 grains back react to the geometry. Basically, what happens is that, remember, we are in 10 dimensions, there are 6 extra dimensions here. The angular part remains untouched, and you have a 5 sphere there. But the radial direction gets combined with the form because the direction of the D3 grain and generates the AES-5 factor. There are a lot of maps between one side and from the other. Here you have a strongly coupled gauge theory. Here you have superiority in a mildly curved background. You will probably see that the isometries of the AES-5 factor, also the conformal group on the gauge theory side, and so on. But this is a great idea. It relates strongly coupled gauge theory to some superiority background. And we are interested in solving strongly coupled gauge theories in the real world. But this is not such a specificity. And this is far from what we see in the real world. And we want to extend this correspondence to see if we can get some knowledge about interesting theories. One of the ideas that one thing that you might want to do is you may want to break some of the supersymmetry. For example, you may want to have an N-1 theory such that you can have chiral map. So one of the possible ways of doing that is by, instead of putting these D3 rays on flat space, is by putting these D3 rays on some singular space. For example, to get the N-1 theory, this is the gravity of it. And you get one half of the supersymmetry broken by the D3 rays, another quarter broken by the gravity of it. So, how this appears on the gravity side? Well, the gravity side appears very simply. The AES-5 factor remains the same, but the 5 sphere there is replaced by another thing, another 5-dimensional space, which is generally called a non-spherical fraction. Another thing that you may want is to break conformal invariance to give some scale dependence on the theory. And to do that, for example, type 2B, you use another ingredient that you have there, so higher dimensional difference, for example, B5 grains. And if you have some two cycles, some two-dimensional space that goes to zero size at the peak of your singularity, you can wrap these B5 grains there. The other 3+1 dimensions appear as your ordinary gauge theory directions. And what happened in the singularity dual is that actually you are turning on 3-form flux, which you only have 5-form flux. And the solution is no longer AES-5, which is fine because I told you that has to do with conformal imbalance. So what we are going to talk about today is about situations in which we have this type of fractional difference. Okay, so let me just here talk about a bit about the language that we're using today. About the typical case theories that arise in this type of constructions and in other things here. There are, in many cases, they have product gauge groups, for example, with SUM gauge groups, with different ranks. Here I call the ranks DI. And the matter that appears usually is either bifundamental matter or absolute matter. Bifundamental matter, I mean things that like, look like the usual quarks, for example, but instead of transforming under some fundamental representation of a given group, transform under two gauge groups. For example, transform under a fundamental representation of one gauge group and a fundamental representation of another gauge group. So we have product gauge groups that by fundamental matter or actual matter. And there's a very simple way to encode this type of gauge group. It's a diagrammatic way to encode the matter content of the gauge theory and the gauge group, which is a quiver diagram. In a quiver diagram, which looks like this, each node represents a gauge group. Here I'm not explaining, explicitly say which are the ranks, but they can have different ranks, for example. And each arrow, each directed arrow, corresponds to a bifundamental field, as forming, for example, in the anti-fundamental representation of the gauge group at the tail, and fundamental representation of the gauge group at the head. So this is one way of representing the gauge theories. The full theory is not specified with that. We still have to say which is the interactions in the central potential. And the central potential is made out of gauge invariant terms. They don't break the gauge symmetry. So they also have a natural representation in the quiver, which is by means of orienting polygons. Each orienting polygon is a gauge invariant, so it's a possible candidate to appear in the central potential. It doesn't mean that every closed polygon is in the central potential. So, what do the fractional brains do at the level of the gauge theory? We will see an example now, but what they actually do is they modify the ranks in the gauge theory. And they modify in such a way that the theory is still anomaly free. I didn't tell you, but anomaly free is that, remember, you want to have an equal number of fundamental and anti-fundamental representations for each gauge group. So, when you modify the ranks, you have to still satisfy this condition. For example, let's say this is theory that it's well known, it's the conifold theory. When you put these brains at the tip of the conifold, the gauge theory that appears looks like that. You put any three brains, you get the theory with two gauge groups, SCM gauge groups, which are the red nodes they are. Then you have four kind of multiplets, which are the arrows A1, A2, B1, and B2. This theory has an SC2 plus SC2 global symmetry, which is preserved by this superpotential here. And again, you see that the superpotential satisfies this rule that I told you, that it's a gauge invariant, so it's a closed loop in the quiver, close around two sides. And the theory is conformal. It's conformal in the sense at least for now that we have three couplings here, we have two gauge couplings and a superpotential coupling, and we can find solutions of all the beta functions vanishing simultaneously, as a function of R charges, if you will, or anomalous dimensions of the field. And what happened in this case is also the conifold, or the base of the conifold has an S2 plus S3 topology, so you can actually wrap a different brain there. So what happens when you wrap different brains and what happens is what I told you before. You modify the ranks of the gauge groups. This is the new theory, looks almost the same superpotential, same quiver, except that you modify one of the ranks of the gauge groups. Basically the difference between the ranks is giving you the number of different brains that you are putting in. And what you see here is that may try to solve for beta functions vanishing, and there's no solution. So the theory has to have some run. The couplings have to run. So how do you study this that situation? Well, you can say, okay, let's put the non-zero number of d5 brains, n, but let's say it to be very small compared to n. So you can think that the fractional brains are really perturbation of the original theory of conformal. and you can expand it in terms of MOM. Okay? So this is what you get. These are the beta functions for the inverse square couplings. You can write down the beta functions for the couplings, so to say. And you can compute the R charges in an expansion in MOM. The conifold is very nice because it has a symmetry. You would expect this is the value of the R charges at the conformal form. It's simple to see that this satisfies that the superposition has an R charge 2 or it's a dimension 3 operator. But you would expect the linear thing here over L, but this is already forbidden. You can already see that the first correction is at most at second order in M over N because the conifold has a symmetry that says M to minus N and M to N plus N. To first order in M over N, this is just inversion of the sign of M. So any correction should appear at most at second order. And you can compute then the beta functions at first order in N, and this is what you get. They are linear in N, which is fine. You want it to be 0 when N is 0, and they are equal magnitude at opposite sides. So now we can understand to study what are the archive flows of this type of theories.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Even in the conformal case, are your bifundamental matter fields charged under U1 charges as well as SU1?
Sorry?
Even in the conformal case,
yes,
as a D3 brain, you have bifundamental matter.
Yes.
Now, have you studied whether they're charged in the U1 as well as SUM?
Well, there's a U1 that decouples, which is the overall U1 because everything is bifundamental, right? So you can add up only U1s and everything is neutral under that.
But you have K minus 1 other.
Yes, and these U1s actually become massive and remain as global in the field. You can compute, for example, anomalies, right? The mixed anomalies between U1 and SUM ratios. Then you can say, okay, my gauge is actually a product of SUMs plus a product of U1s. You can compute triangular anomalies, and you will see that these guys are anomalies. And they cannot be anomalies in a consistent theory, in their gauge. So what really happens is in the string theory construction, they pick up fast. This is something that is well understood. You can compute
not always. In this case, the anomaly will be zero. The theory is not current.
Ah, okay, that's true. We only got that will change the adjustment.
Yeah, in this case, what happens is that you have a conformal theory where you want charge and one decouples because the beta function goes to zero. So there's a global one. You get free electrodynamics.
Yes, it goes to zero.
The ultraviolet will grow.
Yes, but let's talk about it for in the UOB you do have to eventually put something else.
This still would be a long internet, but
what is the something else?
Probably strength in your view or something that you can compute.
Oh, okay.
That's true. Well, this is the only non-chiral theory. Well, I will talk about another non-chiral theory as the talk of Poisson. But in the other chiral theories, they become massive. They become massive, sorry. Okay. So I was going to talk about what is the actual flow. Let's say that we start with a theory with some number of D5 rays, some number of D3 rays. So you know the number of D3 rays is basically the average or the minimum of these two numbers, and the difference is giving you the number of D5 rays. Here the difference is n. So we have opposite beta functions, the same magnitude. This is the usual log of the scale, or archive flow log of scale. These are inverse square couplings. They move linearly. And at some point, one of them hits zero. The inverse square coupling hitting zero means that the theory has a very large coupling. So, in other words, chi square goes to zero, chi square goes to infinity. So, how do you move on beyond this point? Well, this is an idea between Riemann and Strasser. You can try to move to a cyber dual theory and see what happens. And what happens is that in the case of the conifold, the new theory is almost the same. It looks the same. It's only one of the gauges, the one gauge that has to dualize becomes smaller. The net number of D5 rays is the same, is the difference between the two gauge groups.
and then the number of these units has decreased. Mm? And you can compute, you can repeat this process again, again, and again. Huh? So far, I'm working in a limit in which m is much smaller than n, so I'm working really in the tau a. So the characteristic of this flow is that it's a periodic flow, in the sense that at every point you work more or less the same query up to a redefinition of the ranks. The number of leaf degrees, which is the difference, in this case is constant, the number of leaf degrees is linear with the log of the scale. It's the logarithmic flow. But now you can think about what happens at the end of the cascade. When you go to a point where n is no longer much larger than n. But if you can reach this situation, which you have two gauge groups, they differ by m, and they're like that. So how do you read this situation? Well, this is something that you more or less understand. If you look at the green gauge group, it has two n colors. And you consider the second gauge group as weakly coupled, so you have really as a low asymmetry. You see that the node on the left has two n favors, which is the same number of the colors. So this theory really has a quantum modified model aspects. This relation that originally was a determinant of the mesons for these gauge groups minus the values is equal to zero. Now it gets some scale of strong coupling. Okay, and the way to implement this in your theory is you just implement this constraint by adding an auxiliary field, which is acts as a Lagrange multiplier, and external equations of motion for that field gives you really this constraint. And from the geometric point of view, when you look at the Masonic branch of the modular space, this actually giving you a different geometry that wasn't the original one. It's not the coliform, but it's a deformed form. Okay? So basically what we have learned by looking at the coliform theory is that there's a logarithmic flow when you think about the archiflow in terms of a cascade. In the infrared, there's some finite chiral-symmetric wrinkling, which is given by this deformation. And everything is nicely captured by a supergravity solution. This is why we really believe in this interpretation of the cascade and so on. So this opens new questions and motivates the things that I will tell you today, because we also have new developments in the last year or so. One of the questions that you may ask is the coliform behavior generic? So if you take other geometries, if you take other archiflows with fractional rays, will you have that in the end of the infrared all of them become get some deformation, that's all. If it's generic or if it's generalizable, if you want, you may wonder if you can exploit these cascades to generate more structure. For example, if you can have different scales at which different deformations take place. And if you have that, you may want to apply that to some phenomenological models. These warp geometries with fluxes are very fashionable nowadays. Another development that we had in the last year is that we now have an infinite family of explicit Einstein metrics with the geometry, with the gauge theory dual. This is something that we didn't have before. We had the metric for the coliform, we had the metric for T1, let's say the base of the coliform, we have the metric for X5, which is for some flat space, we have the orbifolds of them, we have the gauge theory. Now you have a huge, infinite number of new solutions with gauge theory duals. You may want to use it to construct some cascades. Again, you also have new supergravity solutions similar to the ones that you have for the coliform describing this cascade. This is a work of Klebano, Herzog, and Haas. And there are also some related developments. For example, there's a thing called C minimization, which is actually the geometric dual of A maximization, that now lets you compute a lot of checks of these AES-CFT pairs without even using the metric. And you may want to use that also. And there's also brain tidings, which is a step forward in the direction of giving a one-to-one correspondence between toric singularities and gauge theory. So these are motivations for study what happened in generic algae flows with fractional waves. So let me stop a moment and talk about how to understand complex deformation system of fluid geometry, and in particular, how to understand obstructive deformations in terms of fluid geometry. We are in state theory, so we are in 10 dimensions, and we usually want to get rid of dimensions. And one of the simplest ways to do that is by compactifying things on a torus, not torus, right? You periodically identify coordinates, but one of the drawbacks of that approach is that this preserves as much as supersymmetry as you can, and one of the things that I was telling you is that you want to break supersymmetry. So one of the easiest things beyond tori is this toric biarchies. Again, in this case, they are very similar to tori in the sense that they have a U1 d-dimensional U1 action for a torus vibration. But what happens is that this vibration may degenerate at some point. Okay, so the way in which you specify a given toric geometry is by specifying which are the shrinking cycles and which are the relations between them. Let me tell you just that toric geometries are specified in terms of this type of diagrams, which are called toric diagrams. Basically, they are giving you which are the homogeneous coordinates and how they are charged under some gauge group. And they have a dual representation, which you can see in this case, this is just the reciprocal lattice to that one, which is called the Webb diagram. If you want, you can think about it in a different way. You can say, okay, we are going to think about today about three complex dimensional toric geometries, three dimensional flavials, which are torus, so they have a U1 cube action. So you can model that U1 cube action, and what you are left is with some. It was a cone, now you are left with a polyhedral cone. Right? You model all these U1s, so you have some kind of a pyramid, let's say. And when you slice at some given point in this cone, what you have is this section that is given to you by the web. For every point in the inside, you have a two torus or a three torus. Then on the segments on the sides, one of the circles in the torus vibration goes to zero size, and on the segment on the intersection of segments, two of them go to zero size. This is what we're thinking about. And how do you think about complex deformations? We think, well, it's just the composition of these webs in terms of subwebs in equilibrium. What do I mean by equilibrium? Well, you see that all these webs come with some charges that are telling you which are the directions in which these legs are pointing. There's an equivalent description for mathematicians, for geometers, which is in terms of the composition of toric polytopic in cosmic sound. It's exactly the same. Whenever you can decompose this web into subwebs, I will show you examples, it means that you can decompose this in cosmic sound toric polytopic. So this is what I just said. This is what we're going to tell you is that you will have a deformation that is unobstructive, meaning that you can really do it to any other deformation parameters whenever you can have such decomposition. So let me show you an example. This is a toric diagram for a cone over the Bexel 3. The Bexel 3 is just one geometry for you at this point, but it's toric. So you have n vertices in the diagram, in this case it's 6. You have the difference between these vertices, and what Altman or the mathematicians are telling you is that you can construct this equation where these ci are complex parameters, one for each. Let's say you have n parameters when n is the number of nodes of the toric diagram. And so the deformations are parameterized to by these numbers subject to this equation. So whenever this equation is true up to order k, you say that this deformation is unobstructive up to order k. Okay? You can take it to order 0, you can take it which is true, or the bi's add up to zero, you can take it at first order. It's an homogeneous equation, you can do a rescaling, you take one of the deformations, it's complex. So the first order equation already tells you that there are n minus 3 deformations at first order. And then you can see is where these deformations survive until any order or they are abstracted. This is important because I will show you there are some solutions that were constructed for some deformations that were supposed to exist at first order, but these deformations are abstracted at second order. And this is a decomposition of this diagram.
So is this a sufficient condition for the Minkowski sum, for the decomposition that if we say is it possible that there is no Minkowski, there is no decomposition in the Minkowski sum, and still there are complex deformations?
Yeah, but there is no complex deformation such that this is satisfied to all of
right. Okay. So unobstructed. I mean, is this a sufficient condition?
Yes.
So that's proven that.
Yes. Basically, by alpha, which is
okay.
The condition here is that deformations while preserving SU3 homonymy?
Yes, parallel.
So the
SU3 structures are not.
But so there could be some deformations that maybe they don't have.
So now we can do the following thing. We can try to classify the fractional grains according to different behaviors that they will be present in the infrared. With fractional grains, you have a cascade, you look at what is the infrared behavior of that theory, and you can do a classification. One of them is the simplest case, which is the deformation fractional grains, which are the ones that we have in the coin. How does this manifest at the level of the gauge theory? Well, if you consider the gauge theory without problems, which has D5 grains, the gauge theory corresponds to isolated nodes without fundamentals. Or to bifundamentals with some gauge invariants that are present in superpotential. What that means is that basically you don't have any flat gauge. The gauge invariants that appear there are in the superpotential. So you consider when you compute epsilon equations, you don't have any flat gauge. In the supergravity, what happens is that you can have complex deformations. The same thing that we have in the conic. This is an example. This is another example. This is the epsilon 3 that I told you before. But complex conical epsilon 3. You can have rearranged these legs of the web such that you have a subweb equilibrium and you have a decomposition. You can move this away. This is what you are having here. You may not identify this, but this is really the way describing the coin. So what happens is that you have a cascade for this theory, which has six ranges, which is the effects of three. It's logarithmic, it looks very similar to the one of the coin for in the UV. As you move to the infrared, you will have some deformation. And the deformation, after you do that deformation, you are left with the coin for theory. And this is something that you can do. And there are many examples of that. There are theories that have this same type of deformation at different scales, and so on. You may wonder, this has six gauge loops. This has, the conifer has two gauge loops. You may wonder why, how do you match that things? Well, as in the conifer, at some scale you get confining some of the gauge loops. You get some depth generated for some mesons of that gauge loops. These mesons are gauge invariants and the dark gauge, but are not gauge invariants and the other gauge loops. So basically what they are doing is that they are breaking your gauge symmetry down to the one of the core. Again, this is something that you can really do a mapping between the gauge theory side and the geometric side. Okay? Then there are some very similar fractional grains that we call the n equals 2 fractional grains. What happens is that in the presence of just fractional grains, what you have is that they are flat directions. Or basically what you have is some set of gauge invariants that are not present in the superpotential. I will give you another example of that. This one example. This one gauge theory, this one geometry, it corresponds to CD2 blown up at three quarks. a complex order by simply to learn a few points, but not generic points, so that's why it's not related. So again, you have a decomposition, and what you have at the end, this theory here is basically C2 mod C2, meaning non-refractive on four contexts, this is an equal to zero. And then you have the Helmholtz cone to get rid of the similarity and so on. But sometimes what happens is that you may have a given set of fractional rings, and the given complex deformation is abstract. What are the examples that you can have? Well, you can have examples in which you have, or you can easily see that when you have more possible choices of fractional rings than possible deformations. So you may wonder what happens with the other remaining fractional rings. And so I will tell you, it's more interesting actually. You can have fractional rings that independently lead to supersymmetric dynamics, but when combined, they break supersymmetry. And when we combine, you don't see any complex deformation. We will see what happens there. And this is right to the last type of fractional rings, which is what I'm going to explain, is that any other rank assignments, which are not deformation fractional rings or any equals to fractional rings, what we see is that typically what happens is that one operation gives rise to an affective standard superpotential, and that breaks supersymmetry because you don't have any flat direction. So I will analyze an example in detail. This is basically the work we did in our paper, and there's another paper by David, Herzog, Ouyang, and Pinaski, which is similar conclusions, and another by Bertolini, and Garcia. And basically, why was the motivation to understand all these things? Well, one of the motivations was this exciting with the YPQ theory. So we said, okay, we have all these new metrics, we can repeat all the programs that we had before. You can go, construct your silent solution, your transfer solution, and everything will work in the same way. But what happens is that actually it doesn't work in the same way, but because the game theory behavior is different. Okay, so let me specify about we focus on one example which will capture all the physics, and it's one of the simplest ones you can do. It's a complex form of the vector one. The vector one I told is CD2 done at one point. This is an interesting case for many reasons. One of them is also because it's one of these members of the YPQ family. The horizon, the finite dimensional horizon corresponding to this geometry is what is called Y21, which is a member of the YPQ family. So this is one of the first places where you want to understand what happens to the YPQ. It has an S2, this horizon has an S2 versus 3 topology, so you can see that you can have one single type of fractional plane, which corresponds to this S2. It's the same as the one. And in the UV, it has a logarithmic cascade. This was studied by us, and it was also the superiority solution was constructed by Klebanov, Hass, and Herzog. So now the question of what's happening in the infrared appears. Okay? The web or the reciprocal tritonic diagram looks like this, and you already see that there's no decomposition of the tritonic web. So you cannot expect something like the deformation of the conifer to take place in the infrared anymore. You see that the complex deformation is abstract. Actually, when you read through this situation, I told you, you see there's a first order of deformation, but the deformation doesn't survive at second order in the parameter. So now what you ask is, okay, what this behavior that must correspond to something in the gauge theory, what happened in the gauge theory? What can we see?
Yeah.
Okay. So what is the field theory corresponding to that geometry? This is the field theory. Corresponds to n DC plane, this n, and n fractional rays. You have some modification of the ranks. They have four gauge loops. They have some chiral by fundamental matter charged in this way. The global symmetry of this is C2, cosu1, cosu1, cosu1. The first three terms, C2, cosu1, cosu1, come from isometries. There's some enhancement of the usual U1 cube that you would expect in a three complex dimensional toric geometry. This has an S2. One of the other isometries is related to the R symmetry, and the remaining one is called Flavor symmetry. And you also have a three-cycle where to one, so you can have the reduction of the form from there, giving rise to a baryonic symmetry. Hmm? It's not baryon number, it's called baryonic symmetry, it's a symmetry under which baryons or invaryons are charged. Hmm? And why are they charged? Because baryons would be some B3 rays rather than 3 cycles. And the superpotential looks like this. It's easy to see. You see, you have cubic terms, which corresponds to some triangles here in the mirror. You have quartic terms. Things are contracted in such a way that to be serviced in 2 global symmetry. And another thing that's important is that this triplet that appears there between 3 and 4 is actually a doublet and a singlet of the C2. X34 alpha beta, let's say, and you have X343 appearing there. Mm-hmm. So the potential already tells you that this symmetry, in the angle, they go from the triplet, they form a double plus. So what we are interested to see is what, okay, I turn on this fractional base and we have some logarithmic flow, but at some point, I will reach the point that is as before, the last step in the cascade. And the theory will look like that. One of the gauges will disappear, and the superposition will be much simpler. It will be only these cubic terms that appear there. So now you want to analyze what is this theory. Some of you may recognize, well, now let's see, what is the general philosophy before doing any explanation. We expect this to break supersymmetry. Why? Well, we only have fractional dynamics. Fractional rays are pinned to the similarity. So they don't want to move around. And on the other side, we see that one of the gauge groups generates an ADS superpotential that wants to push these rays out of the similarity. So there's one superpotential that picks everything to the similarity and one that doesn't want things to be at the similarity, at the tip. So this by itself breaks supersymmetry. And we will see that in deep. It has to appear in the gauge theory. So this is what I just said, fractional rays are pitched on the similarity. And let's first see which are diffract directions. Then you have to see that in the gauge theory. These are the diffract directions, which are basically the 6 gauge invariants that you come from there. And F flatness for these two fields, the X34 and the Y34, is that this combination of this is equal to 0. So you see that all these diffract directions, these Mesonic directions, are actually equal to 0. So you already saw at the level of the gauge theory that the diffractional rays want to be pinched at the similarity. So what we see is that classically there are no Mesonic flat directions, and the only supersymmetric point is the origin. But now you can try to study this theory in different regimes. So let's see what's happening when the S3 and gauge group dominates. Okay. Again, we see that the S3M gauge group has 2 echos, meaning that it has less Lagerman colors. And in this case, you expect more respect. There's an ADS of the potential generated for that gauge group, which wants to put the verbs outside the 0, so supersymmetry is broken dynamic. Okay? On the Mesonic branch. So, can we see that in a different regime? Can we see that in the regime in which one of the gauges dominates? Can we see that in the regime in which another gauge dominates? Of course, we can see that, or we expect to see that, because if the theory was supersymmetric in any regime, we didn't expect it to have a phase transition to a non-supersymmetric one as a variety parameter. So we better should be able to see supersymmetry breaking in any corner of your parameter. So you can look at when S2M dominates. And again, well, the simplest way to do it is to look at second one description, which is this one. It has a cubic superpotential. The S3M gauge develops an ADS superpotential, which looks like that. And when you compute the scalar potential coming from F terms, it looks like this one. And the solution is that MT4, which is one of the fields, has to go to 0, and the other one wants to run away. Basically because of this contribution here. It sets MT4 to 0, but this one sets C43 infinity. So we will conclude that there's runaway behavior, but actually there's an iter here that prevents this guy to run away. As long as, so we see again that supersymmetry is very broken. And let me tell you another thing is that this model that we have here, for you, for those of you that know, is basically this, almost the same model that the 3-2 model of supersymmetry ranging of objects affect and cyber. You only have an extra goblet facing to there, but it's the same model. It's a very well known model of supersymmetry ranging.
Is there a gravity wave seeing this ABS potential? Start from that. How does the gravity see this?
No, that I know. So there's no supersymmetry for this 5 hours. And just to kill this model and to see all the ways in which you can study it, you can also consider what happens if you put the DC brake flow. What is the geometry that the DC brake flow sees? So remember that you have this plus 1 equals to 0, but now you have this extra matter and gate flows. And let's focus, for example, on one flat direction. Okay, you can look at the superpotential and you know that there's this flat direction in this case. And what happens is that the, one of the gate loops, again the largest gate loop, has less colors than the flavors, develops an ABS superpotential for the mesons. The mesons for that guy for the SU3N gate loop are this, the following one. Which is a no good tool. You see, you construct these composites. And what you see is that when you do the analysis, is that this guy wants to go to infinity, basically at the distal ring is repaired from the origin. It is fine, it's just a little bit thing that you knew from before, but one of the things that you may get from it is that, okay, it's what we were telling before. Then there's not a complex deformation preserving Calabria, which we imagine is a dual flux. Why? Because we are quite familiar that in these cases there are no forces on the DC rays. In this case, the DC ray is repaired. So what I told you is most simple, the simplest example, which is DB1, we can do all the theory analysis. And what we see is, first of all, we identify that the deformation was subtracted. What is the infrared behavior instead of the deformation? What we see is that there's a supersymmetry breaking. And now we want to see, and actually this behavior is generic, and you can see in other examples which have the same type of subtracted deformation. And this is one of the things that I will do now.
Sorry, can I ask you a question? So you show that there is supersymmetry breaking and there is a runaway vacuum. So how do we think in terms of in a field theory context about field series with a runaway vacuum? Is this a well-defined field theory? You know, the vacuum is a different balance of strength.
There's nothing to say, right, about that. So
I guess what I'm getting to is it possible that this gauge series that are constructed are simply not well defined as a quantum?
No, it's well defined, and then you will have some confusion that at this point we don't understand.
But you usually define series, and so you define it as a UV.
In supersymmetry theories, it's runaway behavior is quite common. I mean, you space, for example, that something will say, like something behind the Kegel potential. But these things go to large waves. In the large waves, the Kegel potential is classic, and you don't expect any funny behavior there. But so this is a common situation.
Well, I can tell you why I'm asking this question, because on a gravity side, there is a negative gravity in the supergravity description of this, and that singularity persists as long as you cannot resolve the
singularity. Well, the singularity is a negative singularity, the solution is called the UV. No, we don't have a solution describing this part of this case.
Yeah, you don't. So I mean, there's a Klebanov-Herzog kind of.
Yes.
That's supersymmetric.
That's supersymmetric, and you show there is a singularity. Now, if I want to resolve, I guess if I see a singularity in the supergravity, you know, in principle, it can be a garbage solution, it can be a wrong solution. So I want to make sure that there is a way to rectify the solution. And if there is a field theory argument, I guess I don't have a field theory argument that there should be a well-defined modification in this theory. So we know there is a modification without the supersymmetry, but it has a runaway vector, so I don't know how.
Well, I guess, again, this, what you say is just the motivation of this work, right? Let's try to know how, let's try to see how to complete this UV solution. What I see is this behavior in the field theory. What is the supergravity dual of that? I don't know. I guess I saw the gravity out thing. Maybe it's this motion out is the SMT structure solution. Well, I don't know. Of course, there should be something because the field theory will be described by some gravities.
Oh, it has to be non-supersymmetric.
It has to be
non-supersymmetric. Yeah, it's a different way. By saying completion, you imply that changing. I'm going to ask this. It's very interesting field theory, which just developed this after the divergence of
the test. You see, the thing is, it's not clear that in this case it actually runs away.
Yeah, this is what.
Why? Why?
No, he had some midterms that wanted to.
Yes, in this case. Side.
Right, so the statement is that you cannot automatically say that the theory runs away because you have this D term that runs away from the naive thing of giving very large res, actually with the classical D term, it has would give you very high energy, so it would stabilize at some finite distance.
Yeah, let's say. Well, I would say, I don't know, I guess I never said that there was a runaway. Maybe you read out the paper.
No, in the sphere, for example, if.
Yeah, I said that there's no runaway because of this term here. I said that. Okay, this term with fixed FI parameter doesn't let you run away.
Right. But I mean, when the sphere M dominates. That's the sphere M dominates.
Oh, no, there's no fabrication at all.
Well, that's even harder to understand.
Well, I mean, there's that's fine, right? There's a proposition.
Yes.
It's polynomial and things, those. You can then ask most other questions. Well, this guy is dynamical or not. So, okay? And what will lead to? But this is something I'm not talking about today. But so far, at fixed FI parameters, which means at fixed geometry, it's very super simple. What I'm saying is all about the Masonic branch, which is where these guys are really describing the motion of waves over the geometry, and they reproduce the geometry. If you want, then we can talk about these terms or baryonic branches of what's happening there. Because this theory is a big variable, right? Because these are rational relations. So you can have variables and you can ask what happens there.
I think he's confused because in the case of an extra program, that one doesn't work.
Ah, well, that's also an example. Program that was to prepare, that's it. Mm. Yes. Mm. Okay, so let me, in the last 5 minutes, talk about some another interesting stuff, which is you can have different type of fractional arrays, which independently lead to some supersymmetric behavior. But when they are combined, can break supersymmetry in the same way. And one of my simplest examples is this one. It is the second one kind of thing we are going to talk about today. It's the suspended pitch point. It's described in this algebraic equation. Because this aspect in the node 1 is an actual field. And it has this superdomain. Okay. There are a basis of fractional arrays which is given by two vectors. One is modifying the second vector by one, and the other corresponds to the first vector. And the second one corresponds to a complex deformation by itself, and you can consider this flow. And the second one corresponds to where I call it was to make. And what I will tell you is that, or I will argue, is that when although the two of them lead to some supersymmetric action flow, when they are combined, they lead to some non-supersymmetric flow in the end. And why is that? Okay, this is a wave diagram or the reciprocal rotatory gyre of the suspended pinch point. And the deformation rate corresponds to take these two red things, combine them into a subway, and move them out. You can study this as a flow from a 50-degree point of view. What you are left with is this Y-shaped diagram, which is basically this diagram looks like that, which is basically the diagram for flat space. So we are left with two equals for theory in the end. And you can study that. And what happened when you put the two fractional maze together, again you see that the deformation factor on our brain is supposed to develop a three sphere, but the other fractional brain, which will get an additional tension by this information, and then we'll try to round to infinity. Okay, this is just a pictorial description, but we see that we can describe that in the case theory as well. Okay. So what I said is that you expect that this A equals two fractional brain, so it's expected to infinity. And you can decide this is some limit. You can consider the limit in which the number of deformation fractional rays is much larger than the number of n equals 2 fractional rays. Again, there's an ADS potential for one of the gauge groups. And there's, again, no supersymmetric vacuum. And in this case, this additional fractional gain was to run to infinity, which is basically the one that I put there. Okay? And to conclude, let me see, tell you that this is actually not a specific case in which this type of behavior happens, but this is actually this is a generic situation in all this geometry. And to see that, we will consider an infinite family of case theories, which is, for example, the YPQ family, now, whose metrics were written by Lambert, Martellis, Parks, and Waldron. They are similar to the conifer in the topology, it's 2 plus 3. They have a single type of fractional maze. And they are toric. They are described by 2 integer numbers, one that branches takes any value, and the other one, Q, that takes value from 0 to P. The toric description of it looks like that. It has some interesting limits. One is the YP0s, which is basically, it's a five-dimensional case. I can consider it console. It's a CP orifold of T1, so the gauge theory corresponds to a CP orifold of the orifold theory. These theories have deformations, as you may guess from the way the diagram looks like, and all the behavior is basically a CP orifold of the conifold behavior. And as you increase Q, the toric diagram moves like that and reaches another point, which is a well-known geometry, which is a C2P orifold of the phi sphere. The gauge theory again, you can compute it very easily. It corresponds to a C2P orifold of flat space. Okay, so this is a generic form. And as I told you, the supergravity solution in the UV has been constant. So, not only that, there's also some first order solution trying to go to the infrared, depart from the logarithmic flow, that was constructed by Barrington, Yu, Mahato, and Sargas. And what I want to say is that this is not a contradiction of what we are seeing today, because what you see is that, okay, you can construct the first order deformation, but you cannot construct the entire deformation. And again, you can prove in the gauge theory that supersymmetry is working in the same way by constructing the generic gauge theory. This gauge theory has 2 building blocks that you can call non-impurity and impurity. If you see this is part of the gauge theory for an orbifold theory, you have doubles and the cubic terms there, yeah, and this is similar to the conifold theory, or the orbifold conifold. And the way you construct the YPQ quiver is by putting these P cells like that, and putting P minus Q. This is one possible phase of this gauge theory, then there are dual phases. But you can take any of them to analyze what happens in terms of supersymmetry linking. And again, what you want to do in this case is construct a general fractional brain. This is something that you can also easily do. What you have to do is just use variable charges of the different fields to construct a rank vector that corresponds to a given fractional brain. I told you there is only one fractional brain. You can construct it. It is a very complicated number, which is a function of P and Q. I'm not writing it here. But what you see is that always for Q less than P, I told you that for Q equals P, you have the order for the conic form. There's this solution, the number of flavors for the last edge groups minus the number of colors is less than zero, after this third way round, the number of colors minus the number of flavors is less than zero. So you have less flavors than colors. So again, an ideal superpotential is generated, and the dynamical superceded rating takes place in the same way. We already saw one example of this in detail, which was the Y21 example. Okay. So let me conclude. We studied the Gray's theory dynamics of fractional grades of some collider singularities. We saw that there are three possible behaviors, deformations, which are the usual ones. And it was to dynamics also, and supersymmetry breaking. That supersymmetry breaking is, in some sense, the generic behavior, even when you combine supersymmetric fractional grades, or fractional grades that lead to supersymmetric behavior. That the key difference between the first two and the last one is that for the last some cases, the corresponding complex deformation is subtracted at some level. This is what I just said. And what I just mentioned briefly is that where we have to study more deeply what happens when the dynamics of the five parameters are taken into account, what credit would you consider the Baryonic branch. And for the reaction as well, it's interesting to see whether you can use this as some hidden set or some interesting phenomenological construction to break your supersymmetry. Okay, that's all.
Si lo tomas, la exposición que tenías, se trae.